The United Kingdom has broken out into riots over the issue of mass immigration and an unfair policing system in place to deal with it. How did this all start and where will it end? That's what we're going to talk about today on Crisis Point Hill. I'm Eric Sammons, your host, editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Before we get started, I just want to encourage people to smash that like button, subscribe to the channel, let other people know about what we're doing here. We really do appreciate it. We continue to grow, and that's because you keep smashing that like button. Also, you can follow us on social media at Crisis Mag. Go to crisismagazine.com and subscribe to our email newsletter as well if you want our articles coming to you every morning, usually two articles a day. So we have one of our crisis writers here with us today, Sarah Kane. She's also known as the Crusader Gal. I almost put Crusader Girl, and I was like, it's Crusader Gal. I'm like, that's kind of demeaning. So if I say it accidentally at some point, I'm apologizing ahead of time because I wrote it down like that, and I was like, oh, no.
No, thank you so much for having me today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. So Sarah was actually born in England and raised an atheist. She had a conversion and was baptized in the Anglican Church at the age of 15. But then her study of the history of the West eventually led her to the Catholic faith, and she was formally received into the Catholic Church in 2022. And now she's basically a commentator on politics and culture in the West. So, where all are you? I know you write for Crisis, and I know you do videos. Where all can we find all the stuff you're doing?
Right. So I do a Substack as well, where I try and do a couple of articles a week there at Homefront Crusade. And then I write, you know, some for Crisis Magazine and some for Catholic World Report and a little bit for Catholic Answers. So but you can find my work at crusadergal.com, and I just link wherever I'm writing, I'll just link straight from there. So that's a good place to stay in touch with me, whether it's videos or articles. Yeah.
Great. And I'll make sure I put links to all this stuff in the show notes. Where did the moniker Crusader Gal come from?
Well, because I wanted to remind people of a time when people were willing to take their faith seriously enough to be willing to die for it. I think that we have this kind of erroneous notion today where we think of Christianity and Catholicism as something that's more tepid, that it's something that should be hidden, that it's something that should be private, and that anybody who is willing to exert their faith, is willing to speak about their faith even, is in some way problematic, that we should be rather cowardly, that that's a virtue, and it never was. And I think it's out of lockstep with history and with our faith specifically. So what I'm trying to do with the moniker is remind people of that time in history where we were willing to actually put everything on the line to fight for our faith, to prevent, as it was, the intrusion of Muslim hordes coming in and destroying what was, you know, the Western civilization, basically, because without those men who were willing to stand at the gates and make it stop, we wouldn't have the faith or frankly, Europe. So I think that's a really important history as we look today into a time where people just aren't willing to speak up about the things that matter, even like even speak, you know, in your personal life, because they think that it's in some way better to be quiet. And I don't think that's true.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, that's very apropos to our topic today. Before I get into that, I am interested because, you know, you mentioned that, your bio mentions that you were grew up an atheist, then you became Anglican as a teenager, then eventually became Catholic. Yeah. Can you just give us like the top view of that? It sounds very, I actually wouldn't mind doing a whole podcast on that, but we'll just stick to the basics for right now. Like, you know, how that happened.
Okay, it's kind of a deeper story, as I'm sure you can gather, but the fast version of this is that I was grew up as an atheist with my mother passed when I was very young, and she had taken her own life, and I ended up in something of like an existential crisis at like 14, 15, because I was trying to figure out why what she did was wrong, and I couldn't fit her action within the atheistic worldview. Because within an atheistic worldview, it's not wrong. You own yourself. You are the end, you know, and you are matter. And I ended up basically reasoning my way into the faith. At that point, the Anglican Church was really the only, I hate to say it this way, but sort of real church in my vicinity at the time. It was them or various like kind of very modernist churches as my two options. So I ended up going there, getting baptized there, against my father's consent because he was a Satanist at the time. So I did all of that. But I wasn't really catechized. There was no catechism like at this particular Anglican church. It was just kind of like, okay, we'll baptize you. We won't teach you anything about the faith. Like here's a King James Bible. you know, that kind of thing. But it wasn't until I ended up doing commentary on the history of the West and also researching, because I want to know what it is that I'm speaking about. It's important to me to speak what is true. It became so obvious that the best of the West was always the Catholic Church. You know, it's not that there's ever been some utopian era. That would be a false assertion. But when it was at its best, it was the Catholic Church acting as this beacon of light throughout, this guiding force. It's also what gave us our history. We wouldn't have it if it weren't for the Catholic Church that recorded it. And so I think that if you were to judge the church by its own fruits, I think it's just unbelievably obvious as to its source. And I think it's beautiful. And just the long lasting thread of it, right? These 2000 years of consistency that you can't have like in any business. Like you'll find some like olive oil from like the 1700s and it's amazing, you know, but nothing goes back that far without something that's holding it together. Frankly, a divine presence that's holding it together. And you can see that in the Catholic Church, and there's so much beauty and just frankly raw good there within that. Yeah. When I came to see that, I just couldn't turn away because it's beautiful.
That is amazing. It is amazing how God just works. And I mean, how people, and I mean, to try to be delicate, your upbringing was kind of rough. I mean, it sounds like, I mean, you know, let's put it that way. But God didn't like ever forget about you and, you know, led you to the Catholic Church, which is amazing. I mean, yeah. So, okay. So let's talk about though, if you're in America and you only get your news from like television, you'd have no idea actually that there are riots going on in the United Kingdom. But if you follow social media, you do know more about it. So some people might actually not know what's going on, is what I'm trying to say. So why don't you give us at least the proximate causes, what exactly has happened over the past month in particular or so that has caused the rioting in the United Kingdom?
Okay. Well, essentially there was a spark that, and I think I'll touch upon maybe later what caused it, but there was this spark that was set off when there was a stabbing that took place in Southport, which is a city, and these children were stabbed, and they were like 6 years old, 9 years old, 11, these really young children. Three of them died, several more were maimed, and they were stabbed by a son of immigrant parents from Rwanda. And originally there was some circulating news that he was an immigrant himself. That wasn't actually the case. But in any case, this has been sort of like a trigger point because there have been so many different terroristic attacks by immigrants and also second generation immigrants who hold allegiance to the Muslim faith. And that's been sort of like a growing anger. And so what you then had after that was some people who came out to protest the immigration policies that had, you know, in their minds led to this. And then there were counter protests by first one group, it depends on how you want to label them. They're kind of like the Antifa of America, right? I think they call themselves Hope Not Hate over there, various different slogans, sort of like communist flags in some cases. There's that group. And then there's also a Muslim group that are now calling themselves the Muslim Defense League, which doesn't seem to actually match their thought process either, because they don't seem to really be about defense, but more offense. And so there have been riots in the country throughout various different cities, like literally dozens of cities have had these riots, and it's also gone into Northern Ireland. And the Muslim Defense League appear to be armed. They are carrying swords and knives, which in the US you might just kind of think, well, you know, people can get a sword if they want a sword, but not really in England. Because over there with the defense laws, you actually can. Like, legally speaking, you can't own or carry a knife. Obviously, you have them for your kitchen, but you can't carry them on your person. You can't have pepper spray. You certainly can't have a gun or a sword, any of these things, but they do. And the response to this has been rather negligible by police, while police have been especially aggressive towards the English protesters who are opposed to immigration policies that they believe have led to this point.
Okay, so you said it was a spark. So obviously, when something like this happens, where there's a major, almost, I mean, obviously, you know, young children being killed is a major deal. But why would that cause rioting? I mean, obviously things led up to this point. So really what has been happening in England over the past years, decades, that kind of led to what appears to be a boiling point at this right now?
And that's exactly what it is. I think it is a boiling point. And over the past several decades, you've had what really amounts to a sort of replacement of people, or at least a demographic replacement from countries that don't even share the same culture. So people specifically from the Middle East, from countries like Pakistan and to some degree Iraq, these countries that bring people over, and to the degree that others are being displaced. So you're creating sort of like net pockets of immigration areas rather than like people acclimating to the culture they're coming to. Instead, you're creating pockets of Sharia law kind of thing where it's not safe for people who are not Muslim to travel. That's why you've had the things like acid attacks that might be in the news. And then you have, you know, over this same period, just so many different terroristic attacks because of the clash of cultures. I mean, I think it's an international story, was the 7/7 bombing, right? But you've also had the Lee Rigby attack, which was the British soldier who was hacked up in on London streets by a Muslim terrorist who, you know, was also living there because the guy was a soldier, because Lee Rigby was a soldier, and the guy was upset over policies that the British government was having in Iraq. There was the Westminster Bridge attack. There was the Manchester Arena bombing. There was two separate London Bridge attacks. Not all of these like reach international news, but they result in this kind of growing tension, right? There's the Reading stabbings, which is exactly what it sounds like, multiple people stabbed. You know, there was the David Amos, the MP, Member of Parliament, who was also stabbed. And then of course, the big event would probably be the grooming gangs, right? So that was when there were literally decades that went by where British police were turning a blind eye to Muslim gangs who were targeting specifically British girls and raping them, in some cases gang raping them. And the British police would not arrest people who were at fault because they didn't want to, as they put it at the time, upset community relations. So it was seen that if they were to arrest the Muslim men who were at fault in these cases, then there would be more riots, people would get upset, and that would be such an evil in its own right that it was in some cases, or in all cases, better to simply ignore the problem. And so what you ended up having is thousands of different girls who were victimized in these horrific ways, and that became normal in a country that, you know, was arresting people for speech violations. So you ended up with this kind of rage that when this story finally broke, because this wasn't just one city, this was cities around the country, Bradford and Leeds and Telford and Sheffield, all these cities throughout England where this same phenomenon had taken place, where these particular gangs, again, they would look away from Muslim girls, they would not target them. So it wasn't simply like girls, it was that they saw an inferiority amongst those who were not of their faith. So they were targeting British girls and specifically grooming and then raping them. And the fact that that was ignored for so long led to a tremendous amount of resentment that is still very much in place. So you're going to have sort of these catalytic events every once in a while where this rage just has not been dealt with. You also have these areas where people have had to leave, like in places like Bradford, where the indigenous British people have become a minority. There are areas that are no-go zones for, like, frankly, white English people, and they've had to sort of relocate a sort of, you know, an unsafe area where people who have been there for generations have to leave. Of course, that kind of thing also creates resentment, not being able to, like, you know, raise your kids in the same place that you grew up or that your parents grew up. That creates resentment. So does the fact that at the same time, they simply don't have the resources to handle this level of immigration. Things like, you know, the national health system is overwhelmed because you're bringing in so many people from other nations that haven't paid into the system, because that, of course, comes from tax money, as does any socialized health system. And therefore, it's just completely overwhelmed. The wait times are just absurd. As I mean, I don't want to give the wrong idea. Obviously, that happens in a socialized system anyway, to some extent, but it certainly can't happen with open borders. It's kind of like if you're going to have an expansive welfare state, you can't also have open borders, but they're trying to do both things at the same time, and it results in just widespread resentment and disorder.
So I know that some of the rioting, some of the incidences have been with communities that are not Muslim, I think Hindu or something like that, I think I read. And so how much of it is a cultural thing, just cultures that come in and don't assimilate and kind of keep themselves? And how much is it really a Muslim thing? Like, how, you know, which one is kind of the more dominant force going on here?
Sure. I think that the issue predominantly is with Muslim groups who have not acclimated and who are also aggressive towards the British. But what you do have is some kind of, the response there becomes weirdly racial, unfortunately. So basically, you know, you have dominantly white, English, you know, ethnically people, and then you have people coming in from the Middle East who are both ethnically different and religiously different. The religious differences results in changes of character, but what people see visibly is somebody who looks different. And so what you end up having, unfortunately, is essentially a very much an us versus them attitude that I think that is not very specific. So eventually it just becomes we don't want any immigrants. Like we just want, right, you know, the English people here, and that's it, because people are fed up. And so no longer are they delineating between one group versus the other. It's just, nope, we've had enough. We're full up. Our resources are out. We can't send our kids to universities because they're, you know, full up. We can't get the cancer treatments that we need in a timely manner because the hospital systems are overwhelmed. You know, we're having to move houses again because this area is no longer safe for us. That's the kind of environment that I think is there at the moment, because, you know, it's a pretty small block of land. And because of that, you just can't, you know, bring in so many people. And what the original system was based around, okay, so if these countries are at war, we accept asylum seekers and we give them whatever aid we can, because, you know, that's a humanitarian action. The trouble is that the system that was put in place for that, in theory at least, would allow people to come in if we were their next adjacent available country. But England isn't the next available country. They're traveling 10, 15 countries to come to the country that has the most expansive welfare state possible. And that's what's actually in place. And England can't accept the entire Middle East, right? That's just not feasible. And so it's just going to get flooded, and nobody's really doing anything about it. And the people who suffer most are these sort of like lower middle class, working class Brits who are frustrated and frankly just irate. And so you've got this constant sort of boiling pot ready for just anything to push it over.
What are the actual immigration policies in England? Like, are these people coming over illegally, or is it just legal what they're doing? And it's just because you have mostly open borders over there.
It's kind of a mix. I think that you do have immigration policies that are still far more friendly than most Brits would be comfortable with at this point. So that's certainly the case. But you have this, like, one of the, I think, big problems is the so-called asylum seekers, who, again, are being accepted as asylum seekers and therefore given sort of a refugee status with a couple of $1,000 a month plus free housing. So that's more than like a native Brit would get. Again, you're going to fuel this sort of resentment. That's there. But you also do have some illegal immigration that's coming in across the channel. But I think it's negligible compared to what is actually like officially sanctioned. And you don't really have politicians who are talking seriously about an actual cap. Like, this is how many people we can actually have. You know, there's nobody's actually saying that because they're afraid of being slandered as racist or something else for so doing.
Now, I know the response has been called all like far right. Anybody who has any objection whatsoever to any of this is just called far right. But I admit it's a little bit confusing trying to gauge the different people because, you know, somebody like Tommy Robinson, you know, he's pretty well known. But yeah. Then you also, I saw like a video what's the guy's name who runs the Reform UK party, Farage?
Oh, Nigel Farage.
Nigel Farage. Okay. Like, he was condemning Tommy Robinson. And to an American, it's like, aren't they on the same side? Like, you know, it's like, so is there a certain element, like, actually tell me what your opinion of those two people are on one thing, but also like, are there elements in that are truly kind of like far right and pretty and are legitimately racist versus people who are just like, hey, this just can't go on. I'm losing my job. I'm losing my house and things like that.
Sure. Yes, there are. And they're all mixed together because they at the moment share some of the same frustration. But yeah, you're going to see, like, if you see some of these riots, every once in a while, you'll see like a Nazi flag in the middle and you're like, what is going on there? Right. And it's because there's somebody who is legitimately just like, you know, fully neo-Nazi, who has found himself and just, you know, thinks he's amongst friends, and he's really not. But he essentially is making it possible for the mainstream media, certainly, to use this very broad brush and say they're all far right. But I think it's also important to say that, like, the Overton window is different in Britain. So what's far right in Britain would just be sort of ordinarily conservative in this country. If you were to say that you wanted a privatized healthcare system in England, that would be considered a very far right policy. Nobody's saying that in England. Not really. And yet that's a pretty mainstream position here as a conservative in America, at least it would be, you know. And similarly with immigration policies, if you wanted to close the borders to immigration, just say, hey, we're full, this is enough, we need to, you know, catch up with our different industries and fix things before we reopen or what have you, that would be considered a far right policy. So you kind of have to, like, realize that the Overton window is sort of shifted so far to the left that everything's kind of far right that is sane, in my opinion. Right. And I mean, Tommy Robinson and Nigel Farage are in different boats. I think that Nigel Farage is much more what I would consider kind of libertarian and not really what you would say like an American conservative. He became very popular, of course, during Brexit,
right?
Which is an important movement. And I'm glad that they actually, you know, voted to leave, even though that's kind of its own drama. Tommy Robinson is more involved in being opposed to immigration rather than simply opposed to the European Union. And he has some history of just getting kind of like caught up in the different aggressiveness. And I think that's why Nigel Farage is trying to, like, you know, delineate himself from Tommy Robinson, who is, I think, at times a little bit too easily dragged into some of the physicalities there. Okay. So that's the big difference from where I stand. Yeah.
And Farage, I guess he's a politician, so he has to, yes, remain respectable. And so he can't, like, be associated with people who might not be respectable, yes, like that. Now there's the whole issue that it's kind of seems to be making things worse, which is the whole two-tiered policing system. Mm-hmm. I just, by the way, I mean, how great is it that the new prime minister's name happens to rhyme with tier? I mean, it's like, you know, it's like, so you can have two-tier tier. But yes. I mean, so what is going on here? Is it just simply that the police are afraid of being called racist, or they're afraid of actually Muslims attacking them? Or why is it that there seems to be this, at least everybody seems to agree, like, well, not everybody, but like, seems to be clear that the way they police whites is different than how they police people of different backgrounds.
Hugely. Yes. And that was, of course, seen especially during the grooming gang era, if that was an era. But for decades, that was certainly seen with how those groups were treated. I mean, these were like literal rapists of like 13, 14-year-old girls. And the police looked the other way and refused to prosecute. And that has just kind of been extended, I think, to the way that these police treat different, as they call it, special interest groups. So they seem to view one side is essentially protected classes, and that's a concept that the political left in America uses, the term, you know, protected groups, and that's something that the British police have used as well to refer to certain groups, like, you know, it's the same stuff. It's the LGBT group, and it's the Islamic group, and it's immigrants in general. They're considered to be vulnerable groups, and therefore are treated differently. But they're not vulnerable if they're treated differently, if they're treated better. It actually means that they're treated as a preferential group. And instead, what ends up happening is that the other group becomes the victimized group. Because that's not the way that the law is supposed to work, of course. You're supposed to treat everybody the same, you know, before the law. Otherwise, you don't have a just system. And really, they don't have a just system. Because what you see especially, and if you're a Brit who's living over there in England, one of the things that you would fear is them showing up at your door because of something that you posted online, right? That would be one of the most likely interactions that you would, as an ordinarily law-abiding person, would have, is them coming and saying, hey, that thing that you said on the internet offended somebody and we received a complaint. Therefore, you're under arrest. And that's something we don't even think about.
Hold on a second. Now, us Americans, this is where we cross the line. Like, okay, this is, thank God we left these people, 200 some years ago. Because, I mean, I just saw this online this week. It's gotten to be a big deal. I mean, where UK official government UK accounts are basically saying, think before you post, or doing videos about you. And then there's examples of some guy, I think he just like replied on a Facebook post something. And I think he just said filthy, I'm not trying to keep it family friendly, B word. But anyway, and he got I think it was like months in jail for that.
Yeah.
And it's just, that's insane. I mean, the guy might be a complete jerk. I don't know what he's commenting on, but to go to jail for that.
Exactly.
To an American, it's just insane. So how long has it been that in the UK, I mean, clearly you don't have free speech. They don't have free speech right there, but how long has it been that like just posting things online, you can get arrested for?
I believe it was 2007 where it became illegal to quote, incite racial hatred. Which is sort of weirdly broad because
would only be one white direction though, I'm sure.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So that was absolutely towards like white people who are against any other group or, are perceived that way. But even that, it's like, when you think about it, well, how can you incite hatred? Like you can't, I mean, I'm responsible for the opinions and, like actual emotional response of someone else, because it's one thing to say, can you say something offensive towards, a different racial group or wrong, perhaps. No, it's like, actually, can you incite hatred? Can you incite that emotion in somebody else? It's really kind of subjective. But that's how it started. And then from there, it just sort of expanded into the state where we are now, which I think was around 2011, it expanded to you cannot actually cause offense, which is unbelievably broad. And again, this is also very two-tiered. No one's knocking on the doors of, the Muslims over there and saying, hey, that thing that you said was offensive towards, some homosexual, for example. That's simply not happening. Instead, you very much have this levied at the English and at Christians. So you've had several arrests of street preachers who have like quoted from the Bible, for example. And there's one famous one that I can think of where an officer goes up to an individual and says, do you think that homosexuality is a sin? Did you say that? And the guy said, yes, homosexuality is a sin. And he arrests the guy for saying that homosexuality is a sin because that is offensive to people. And so it's this kind of an environment that I think that Americans just can't fully grasp what that's like, because we've lived in this, honestly, just free speech environment, and we just assume that the rest of the world is like that. And actually, it's very unique. And you think that a country that is, at least formally speaking, first world, like England, would also share the same understanding of people's willingness to speak truth. Because ultimately, on a personal level, that's what matters. It's like, can a person actually speak what is true? And in terms of English law, no, not if the truth is offensive.
My American brain's still trying to wrap around that. I mean, Americans typically think of like Britain just being kind of like us, just a little more snotty about it. I mean, just, they're not, I mean, we know they're not like, America type people, but still, right. I mean, in fact, the truth is our free speech and a lot of our laws are based upon the English common law heritage. So it's like they're abandoning their own heritage. Now, do you know if there's been any response from like Catholic leaders or Anglican leaders over there that is kind of trying to, I mean, that's helping at all? Or is it, my guess is, knowing how our leaders are here, they're just going along with the nonsense. But do you know of anybody over there who's like a Catholic leader, especially, who's speaking up against what's going on?
Sadly, I don't. So if they're doing so, they're not doing so in a public enough manner. And I know that the Anglican leaders, I mean, you've just got female bishops at this point, so it's just kind of looked the other way. But with Catholic leaders, I mean, I don't think there really are any who are speaking up loudly. And I think that we're in a sort of a time where, if they were to do so, they would face persecution. And yes, that goes kind of with the faith, and that would be their duty. But again, we're sort of in this time where people are very much afraid if they're going to have any pushback from a state, they don't do so, as we saw during COVID internationally.
Right. Now, is there any, I don't mean to be super cynical here, but is there any hope really here? Because, I put this on X the other day, that the number one boy's name last year for baby boys was Mohammed in the United Kingdom.
Yes.
Now, of course, I know that a lot more percentage wise, most Muslims name their boys Muhammad. I mean, all the next 19 were English type names, but still it was the number one name in UK for new boys. It was Muhammad. And so it seems like at this point, Islam is eventually just going to take over. And of course, the irony of ironies of this is all the liberals who are allowing this to happen will be all shut down at that point.
Yes.
Under Sharia law and everything. So, but is there any, I mean, do you see any path other than just like a miracle from God that would keep the United Kingdom from going down this path?
It would require God. In a few ways, I think, because a part of the problem is that England has for so long now been a remarkably secular country. They've been trying to run the country in a very secular way, especially since around World War II. And the trouble with that, and obviously there are a few different eras there, but you end up with a need to fill something on an individual level. I think that every human heart yearns for God, I do. And what you end up having is this, when there's an influx of another religion, it ends up sort of taking the place of it. And so within that secular world, you kind of have this replacement with scientism and increasingly, I think, with Islam. And those are the two that I think are going to clash. But if things were to turn around, you would have to have a reordering of public and private life with Christ as head. That's really the only way, because right now, a big part of the problem is that they don't have an understanding of rights, because they don't have an understanding of natural law, because that requires an understanding of God. And so it really all comes down to that. They are completely without any sort of grounding. And, you know, whenever I do a video about something in England, you kind of get like a lot of English viewers who come over and they get kind of irate if I say anything about God, because they just don't see the connection there. And that's the thing. It's like, it really is a very atheistic society. And I think that's fundamentally one of the issues, is that there can be no solid value system without Christ. Instead, you end up with this relativistic system of what works for today, and then what works for tomorrow might be a little bit different, and you end up sort of sliding around. And instead, they're sort of making a religion about what can offend certain minority groups, because those minority groups are specially protected. That doesn't make any sense, and it's not a way to sort of build a civilization. We've built civilizations before. The Catholic Church has, you know, that's kind of its thing. It is building a civilization, and I think that in order to reverse the course of Britain, it would have to refind the faith. At the moment, because it has so abandoned it, it's going to be most vulnerable to enemy faiths that move in, whether they are things like Scientism or things more like Mohammedism or Islam.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is Islam, I mean, the problem, of course, like you were saying, the relativism of like the atheistic worldview, it just can't stand up to a strong, like disciplined system like Islam is. It's false. Yeah. It's got a lot of evil in it, but at the same time, it's very much disciplined. It knows what it believes, and it's willing to do literally just by anything to promote it.
Yeah.
And so you know who wins that battle.
The English are having an identity crisis. They really are. It's like they have no idea who they are or what they are. When I was in school, there was a point when I was like probably 14 years old. And then the National Union of Teachers, the NUT, wonderfully named, they had this announcement saying that they didn't want to cover the history of the British Empire or colonialism, because it would lead to, as they put it, BNP-like thinking. And the BNP was the British National Party, so it's a nationalistic party. And so for that reason, they specifically would only teach a very sort of narrow understanding of British history to prevent British children from having a nationalistic worldview. So a very, it's odd to think that you would like deprive children of the truth so that you can gear their opinions in a certain direction, but that's what they're doing, or what they were doing at the time, and I presume what they're still doing today. But I think that's also emblematic of a sort of worldview over there of just sort of shame. Like, they don't know who they are, they don't know what their values are, because modern values are so out of congruence with historical values, because the historical values were Christian. And now they see Christianity as something bad and something weirdly racial as well, which also is bad. And therefore, they don't know who they are, what their values are. They don't know how to define themselves. They don't know what is good about being English. They don't see anything, you know, worth defending in terms of being English or in terms of being British. And therefore, what's the problem with unlimited immigration from a different culture? They don't see any reason why that culture is any worse than their own culture. And to say so would be racist or in some way evil. And therefore, in the midst of this entire identity crisis, they have no idea what to do. Whereas the people who are coming in from the Middle East know exactly who they are, what they believe, and what they want, right? They want to spread Islam throughout the world. They have this very, you know, specific value system, how to do it and how they're going to treat other people, you know, inside and outside of their faith. They know exactly, you know, where they're going. So these two different, let's call them worldviews, it's obvious that one is going to run roughshod over the other. There's no, you know, alternative to that.
Yeah, I mean, here in the States, of course, we've got the whole movement of being ashamed of our history, of just denigrating everything American. Well, there's no bigger baddie when it comes to the liberal mind view than the English Empire. I mean, the British Empire. I mean, that was, I mean, they really were the epitome of what they consider evil, because, you know, they colonized everywhere. They, you know, had this powerful, spread, you know, it was Anglican. And so problematic, but it was more Christian than it is today. That's for sure.
Right. Spent decades destroying slavery, banned things like the burning of widows in India, literally spread civilization, faith, law, you know, throughout the world. So, and all those things I think are considered to be bad amongst the group that you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, it's just insane. Do you think it's possible? I mean, because you talked about a few times about the frustration rising. Do you think it's possible this could break out into like an actual civil war, an actual physical? I mean, there's physical combat going on right now, incidents, but like a real, like organized type of civil war even.
I do think it's possible. I think it's unlikely with this particular singular event. But I wouldn't be surprised if a couple of years down the line, you won't have another set of riots and then another set, you know. I mean, there was a big set of riots in 2011. You know, we keep having them because the roots of the anger are not being dealt with. So I do think that it's very likely that at some point this will exacerbate to such a point that you end up having a much more violent altercation. And right now, I think the only thing that's really lacking from that, or the main thing, is leadership. They don't have an actual organized leadership with a set of goals and what they actually want to accomplish. Instead, you have just random people who would normally be at the pub on the Saturday night instead being out in the streets because they don't know what to do anymore. And that's, you know, that's where they are right now. But if you were to actually organize that over several years, I mean, you could have something quite devastating over there. And, you know, it's why the British political class ought to be paying attention to the fact that they are not actually representing the desires of the people. The people never asked for this. The people never voted for this, the sort of things that they're experiencing. So it's understandable that you'd have these levels of rage that are going on, because the rage is a response to an injustice, and you really do have so many injustices that are taking place. So I don't think we've seen the last of it. That's for sure.
Is there a political party that kind of represents this? I mean, I know the Reform UK is relatively new, but that's not really, doesn't seem, I mean, I know it's somewhat anti-immigration, but is there a political party that kind of really represents the very anti-immigration nationalistic kind of viewpoint?
I don't think that there's a decent one at the moment, because you just kind of have like various different extreme groups. I think that we're still waiting on something, because it's very different to the American system, where it's like you just kind of very much have a two-party system.
Right.
Over there, it's more common to have a 7-8-party system, and some of them come and they grow and then they disappear. So that does happen. And because of the parliamentary system, they also can have power pretty quickly, even though they're a fairly new party. So I think that we should just kind of like hold on and wait for such a thing to develop. But one of the problems is that once you have an anti-immigration party like you're talking about, so many of them just keep getting arrested. And we keep seeing that over the past decade or so, is different leaders who are distributing, say, stickers about the immigration issue being arrested for extremist content. Because now you also can't own materials that would incite, right? So that includes like templates for stickers and PDFs and that kind of thing, which is the latest of the sort of draconian speech laws.
You know, if I wanted to set up a way to have Islam take over the United Kingdom without it actually being a military invasion, I can't imagine a better way than what's actually happening. I'm not saying there is some mastermind behind this. I think it's more incompetence and just, like you said, not really being confident in who they are and all that stuff. But at the same time, this is the script that would just say, okay, in, 20, 30, 50 years, it's predominantly Islam, and therefore the politicians will be, and now we have a Muslim country.
Right. And don't forget, of course, that the people who are coming in are way more likely to have children and way more children, whereas the British populace is a contracepting society, I'll put it like that. And so they have very few children. I don't think they're at replacement levels like most of the Western countries, except for maybe Hungary and Poland. So that you've got that kind of problem. Then at the same time, another problem you have is that Muslims vote at a really high rate. So almost 100% of Muslims vote. I think the British populace, last time I checked, and it's been a while, so forgive me, but it was a little bit less than 30%. So when you do have an area that sort of, you know, ends up having a lot of this new immigrant class and they all vote, very quickly they get to control the city council, and then, you know, they get to make the decisions that affect the area. And so that also, again, it feeds the resentment, it makes things worse rapidly. So like you said, if you wanted to take over and make Britain into a Muslim state, this is how it would be done. And again, I don't see any great conspirator behind the scenes doing so, besides, you know, the Muslims themselves, who obviously want to spread their religion throughout the world. But besides that, you know, it's just the identity crisis is not capable of resisting an encroaching culture that it's unable to assert is worse than its own.
Right. So I think the long and short of this is we need to pray for England.
Most definitely. They need them.
I do think, and it does matter to Americans, because typically a lot of this stuff then comes over here. I mean, it impacts us. And I mean, obviously England is our number one ally. And so like, if it becomes a essentially Muslim country, that's a major impact on us as well, because that impacts Europe and I mean, just a whole bunch of stuff. So, oh boy. So, okay. So we'll wrap it up there, but remind us again, I'll put links in the show notes where we can find your writings, your videos and things like that.
And certainly. So the best place just to find me is at my website, crusadergal.com. So that's crusadergal.com. You can also find me on X. Just search for The Crusader Gal, and I'll come up there as well.
Okay.
Thank you so much for this opportunity, Eric. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. And sometimes you'll see her writings at Crisis. Do you link to them at your Crusader Gal site?
I do.
Okay, perfect. So I appreciate you coming on this. This was kind of last minute. I was like, this all came up. I was like, I need somebody. And I was like, okay, I'll ask Sarah, because I know she follows this stuff very well. So I appreciate it a lot.
Thank you.
Okay, until next time, everybody. God love you.